Welcome to the award-winning legal news and review recognized from the Florida Bar Award of Excellence, featuring the law firm of Santucci Fiore Fiel, practicing intellectual property, business, and entertainment law and litigation. Located in downtown Fort Lauderdale is Mike Santucci, legal panel attorney who co-chairs the intellectual property section of the Broward Bar. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law, also syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his fields of practice. And nationally known criminal defense attorney, Gary Ostro, Esquire. Over 30 years defending the accused in both state and federal courts. With over 500 jury trials to his credit, Gary Ostro's practice focuses on Fourth Amendment issues as related to search and seizure, as well as federal civil rights cases against police officers, as well as the departments and city in which they operate. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's broadcast, the U.S. Supreme Court just made it a lot harder for you to sue your employer, and that's because of mandatory arbitration. And nearly one-third of all federal wage and hour lawsuits filed each year are filed in Florida. And now with more people working, employment law touches so many lives. And today, from the law firm of Gallup, Albrecht, did I pronounce that right?
Gallup and Auerbach.
Auerbach. Very good. Dana Gallup, who you just heard, for over 25 years focuses practice in the area of civil litigation with an emphasis on employment law. He's also certified by the Florida Supreme Court as a civil, county, and circuit court mediator and arbitrator. Dana represents employers, but also employees, which is very unique within this profession. But first, I'd like to welcome the legal panel for today's program. Good afternoon, Gary Singer.
Hey, how you doing today, Phil?
Another day in paradise, Gary.
It really is when I'm with you, Phil.
Hey, man. People are beginning to talk. And, of course, Gary Ostro.
Good to be here. Good to be back.
Yeah, it's good to see you in men's clothes for a change.
That's very nice, Phil.
I couldn't resist as well. I want to remind our listeners they can actually watch the production live on Thursdays at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. You can watch also archive programs. Just Google Facebook, Legal News and Review, and you'll see we're recording live at the Kelly Ustahl Building in their forensic mock courtroom. You know, Kelly Ustahl Law Firm is committed to helping you seek justice. Go to justiceforall.com. That's justiceforall.com. Attorneys all over the country refer cases to Kelly Ustahl because of their resources, but also, importantly, their successes. If you've been severely injured because of someone else's negligence, you need answers. You can call them at 954-522-6601. And being this is broadcast at the beginning of drive time, you can't do that while you're driving, just go to justiceforall.com. Dana Gallup, welcome to Legal News and Review.
Thank you for having me.
Dana, what is federal wage and hour lawsuits? What do they actually consist of? And why do you think nearly one-third of all filed each year come from Florida?
Well, federal wage and hour lawsuits come under the Fair Labor Standards Act, or the FLSA.
Right.
And they deal with minimum wage and overtime. And so this law came into effect post-Depression, I believe. And obviously, as you know, minimum wage has gone up through the years. Overtime has generally always been time and a half of whatever the wage is. But their second question is actually the more interesting question, I think, why there's so many claims in Florida and in particularly South Florida. And that's something that my colleagues and I have been discussing and debating for quite a while now.
So what do you think? I mean, because that is something that's extremely notable.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one theory batted around was, well, it's a fairly substantial immigrant population.
Okay. And, but it's not the only place for sure.
And that's the answer that we get back as well. But that we outrank California, we outrank Texas.
Really?
By substantial numbers. And obviously other border states as well. Now, so that's not the answer.
A friend of mine, he had an employee he was paying over $60,000 a year for, but mm-hmm. he was an employee, not a manager.
Mm-hmm.
And after 3 years, he decided to phase him out. And then he got sued because the guy used to come in on weekends, bring work home. I mean, he something that seemed not as little as it sounds actually cost him over $100,000.
You know,
is
Phil?
Is that traditional? Is that common?
That would have been more believable if you let out the beginning where you said a friend of mine.
It happens frequently. The biggest, one of the biggest misconceptions of of overtime law,
right,
is that if you pay someone on a salary, you do not have to pay them overtime. That's probably the number one thing I hear that is just flat out wrong. And in fact, not only is it wrong, but if someone is non-exempt, meaning they're entitled to overtime,
right,
and you're paying them on a salary, and maybe you're paying them, like you said, a substantial salary, $60,000 a year, then the overtime that is owed is based upon a calculation of what comes down to the regular rate, basically dividing the weekly salary by 40 hours and coming up with a number. So you could imagine if, I'm not going to do math here on the air, but if you have a substantial salary,
right,
let's say you make let's go with $1,600. What would be a good thing divisible by 40? But anyway,
400.
Let's say you end up making $40 an hour.
Right,
it's a good random guess.
So you're making.
This isn't an accountant show, Dana.
You're making
$40
an hour. $40 an hour, and you work 60 hours in the week.
Right.
Well, that extra 20 hours is at $60 an hour. So now you're taking 40 hours times 40, and then you're adding another $60 an hour times 20. That adds up pretty quickly.
And they get their attorney's fees too, don't they?
That's another reason why a lot of lawyers have jumped into the field, because you automatically will get attorney's fees. The amount may be within the discretion, of course, of the court, if you can establish that any money is owed at all. And it's a one-way street. If the employer defeats the claim, the employer is not going to get any attorney's fees back from the from anybody.
But why did the Supreme Court make it a lot harder to sue your employer by making mandatory arbitration legal?
So mandatory arbitration has been growing in employment law for a number of years. And what employers have figured out is if they can get their employees to sign an arbitration agreement, then they have waived effectively their right to a trial by jury. And then a little bit more insidious from the employee's perspective is that there are what they call class action waivers in those same agreements. So we were talking about Fair Labor Standards Act.
Right.
The average Fair Labor Standards Act claim is usually pretty small. Maybe someone's owed $1,000, $2,000. And so the purpose of the act was to allow for what they call a collective action, not even a class action. A class action, everybody's in unless they opt out. Well, a collective action is you come forward with a couple of plaintiffs and you get the court to agree to a collective action certification. And now you send notice out to every single employee, present or former, within the period, and you end up with a class or a collective action. And what these arbitration provisions are doing is they're saying, no, you cannot, you've waived your right to bring a collective or a class action, and now you're in arbitration and you don't have a jury trial. And in my opinion, mandatory arbitration is not necessarily a fair thing. There's unequal bargaining power between the employee and the employer. I mean, the employee wants a job. So is the employee going to say, no, I'm going to not take this job?
That's
because
such an unfair. No, I mean, before I forget, Phil, the Supreme Court doesn't make something legal. They confirm that something is constitutional.
I'm sorry, you're right.
But, you know,
well, you're an attorney. You know that.
Grown-up humans who are not otherwise disabled and have full capacity, who desire to make a agreement with each other for mutual benefit, should be bound to that agreement unless it's immoral or against public policy by being so reprehensible.
Sure.
We're not living anymore,
contract,
at least in most places, and I think this should be something that should be looked at, you know, in looking at these cases, in a place where there's only one place to get a job, like you got to go work at the company store. You know, this is South Florida, for example, that's where we're living and talking. If you don't want to agree to Walmart's, you know, arbitration clause for your employment, go, you know, be the shift manager at, you know, Walgreens or Target.
What's your point?
The point is that why is it wrong to expect employees to agree to something If you don't like what the employer is offering, you don't take the job.
Because
to begin with. I'm not saying be abused when you get there. But
well,
don't
I think
take the, job
I think the
begin
problem
with.
Is that as more and more employers go for this option, and frankly, I see it in every size and kind of employer, you as an employee run out of options.
Well, no, you don't. You vote in politicians who change that law, and
well,
then the Supreme Court
sure.
follows the law,
sure.
and that's how our whole society changes.
Sure.
It just seems unfair to pick and choose. The employer will pay employees a certain rate based on certain promises they're going to make, such as not as arbitrating, for example, rather than having more expensive cases if they're accused of something. That's part of their pricing and how they price their products and how they pay their employees. If a company is going to decide or the law states, well, you can't do arbitration clauses, then they're going to pay a little bit less to offset the additional cost of the lawsuit. It's like wanting to have it both ways. It's like going into a real estate contract that's as is, then seeing that it needs paint and wanting the seller to lower the price. No, your choices are cancel or don't cancel. You agreed it was as is. So cancel if you don't like the paint. Don't ask them to change it after they already priced it based on the as is part. So that just seems wrong
well,
to
Gary,
me.
Well, Gary, let me ask you this. This is to you. You own Gibraltar Title. You bought it.
Yes, I own it. It's mine.
One of the oldest. It's large.
I think
you have several employees.
The oldest. Yeah.
But you have several employees, and I know you have a drug-free workplace.
I do.
No tolerance. Zero tolerance to drugs.
I didn't know that. I like
but
Arian.
But marijuana now is illegal. I mean, it's legal.
Uh-huh.
Because it can be prescribed by a physician. What would you do if somebody came to you and said, hey, I'm taking a prescription for pot?
Well, I, first of all, don't have a drug-free workplace. I really could care less what people do in their off time.
Where did you get that information?
I don't know where you got that idea. But if I did, actually, and I'll defer to our guest
yes.
to see if I can care about that. But if let's say I made an agreement with one of my employees where they agreed in order to get the job that they wouldn't do drugs.
But federally, marijuana is illegal.
Yeah, but so what? They agreed that they weren't going to do drugs
but
by working
it's a prescription
here.
Medication.
Yeah. But even they agreed.
But what if it's medically necessary?
Well, let's take that out of it. Okay,
let's not.
Well, no, people have a right to do what's medically necessary.
Dana,
prescribed
what would you
to them,
advise?
You can't stop that.
What would you advise your employers that you
well,
represent?
First of all,
can you have a drug-free workplace anymore?
You can absolutely have a drug-free workplace. And, you know, absent a contract, the vast majority of employees in the state of Florida and around the country are at-will employees. So the mm-hmm. meaning of that is you can terminate an employee for any reason or no reason at all, and the reason doesn't have to be moral
unless
or ethical.
It's unless
there's certain statutory prohibitions, such as being in a protected class, gender,
right.
race, sex, national
right.
origin,
federal
disability,
rights. Civil rights.
Religion, et cetera, or certain protected
is political
conduct.
Party protected in that
no.
case?
No.
Okay.
Well,
it could be arguably.
I tell you, in Broward County, there is an ordinance that says that you cannot take action against someone because of their political affiliation. So
that's a good rule.
There actually is. But federal and state, I don't believe so.
Okay.
So my point is, yes, you can have a drug-free workplace, but whether you have one or not, there's nothing that stops you as an employer from terminating someone because they did take drugs, or maybe you want them to take drugs and they're not taking drugs, you can fire them for that reason too. Or you can frankly fire someone because they took an aspirin. It doesn't matter whether it's legal or illegal. You can fire someone because you don't like the way they parted their hair on a Wednesday. So
as long as it's not federally protected.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
By that you mean discrimination.
So that's good to know.
Right.
So then if you could fire someone for no reason, why would there be that many lawsuits for wrongful termination?
Because of all the exceptions to the rule
that we were talking about.
There you
so
go.
Fair enough.
So, that's when you analyze a termination case or an adverse action case, failure to promote or whatever, you look at, is the person in a protected category? And frankly, there's so many protected categories. And if you use reverse discrimination, then everybody's in a protected category, right? Because you're either white or black, or you're a man or a woman, or you get the point. or protected conduct, did someone complain about discrimination or sexual harassment? Were they fired because of that? Are they alleging that they suffered injury on the job and filed a workers' comp claim and were fired in retaliation for that? Did they serve on a jury trial and they were fired because they didn't show up to work because they were in a jury trial? So there's all sorts of – do they take family medical leave time or try to take advantage of that?
Well,
Dana,
so
there's a lot of exceptions.
To these cases – I got involved in a civil 1983 case, wrongful termination
mm-hmm.
with retaliation.
Retaliation, sure.
But I've learned since is that very difficult cases to establish prima facie by design because there was a lot of abuse and too many people were filing too many wrongful termination suits. The federal court seemed to have weeded out those claims by making it very difficult. Would that be some truth to that? Do the cases go to trial, or do they usually settle pretrial?
So there is truth to the fact that, particularly in federal court, they've raised the bar, so to speak, as to what you need to get to a jury. But with regard to all the types of employment cases, in my experience, retaliation cases are actually a little bit easier than your garden variety discrimination case.
Because you can have discrimination without retaliation. Right?
Sure.
Of course.
But right. And so discrimination, that you know, there's usually not direct evidence, right? No one's coming out and saying, I'm letting you go because you're African-American.
Right.
No one's saying that. So you have to prove cases through circumstantial evidence. Now, the retaliation part of it, while it may also be circumstantial because someone's going to say, I'm firing you because you complained about discrimination.
Right.
But what we have is the benefit of the elements, one of which is temporal proximity between the protected act and the adverse action.
Alleged retaliation.
And what basically the courts have said is if you complain about discrimination, and there's another area of discussion as to whether the complaint was objectively made in good faith, but let's assume it was, and you get terminated within, let's say, a three-month period of time after your complaint, there's basically some form of presumption that there's a causal relationship between those two events. Now, if it goes beyond 3 months, you really have a hard time convincing a federal judge that there's retaliation because, again, I think it makes sense. You know, if you're going to retaliate against someone because you're mad that they are complaining about you, essentially, you usually don't lay in wait for
a year.
Let
me get this down.
Or revenge is better served cold if you want to avoid that.
That's only if you're working for the Russians.
Appearance of...
Right. Now, I mean, we have cases where we establish what I call like stepping stones, right? So you didn't get terminated right away, but a week later you got your first negative review.
Right.
And 2 weeks later you got a demotion.
That's how I would do it if I was an employer to avoid detection, if I could use that term.
Well, also, frankly, to be honest, I think a lot of employers at that point might be trying to encourage the employee to find another job through resigning. Like,
to be kind.
After the fifth warning, maybe you're saying, well, maybe the writing's on the wall here.
But let me ask you a question. Wait 1 second, Gary. You've been practicing for how long?
How does it feel?
I never get to
For 26 years.
For 26 years. And you've had many occasions when we spoke where one of your employers got messed up and you said, why didn't you call me? And they didn't want to spend the money.
Yeah.
You know? So to
that's
be proactive saves you money all the time. But you have a program that you offer as a retainer program
that's
for employers.
Yeah, most of my employer clients are on monthly retainers. And, you know, what I found, a lot of my my employers are small to medium-sized businesses.
You represent only employers or do you represent
plaintiffs? I do represent both employers and employees. But on the employer side, they range from a couple of people to, I think, my largest employer client now has about 1,900. So, but it's a range.
Wow.
But what I find is that especially the smaller employers, they don't want to spend money on a lawyer, and they don't particularly want to call a lawyer and they get a bill for a 0.3 call because they asked a question.
That's why I write everything up to an hour.
So, they don't want that bill. They don't want that bill either. So what you find is people do what they do, and then when they get sued, you know, they wait until they get sued. So I tell them, look, pay me a flat fee. Right. Call me or email me as often as you want. Let me come in for that flat fee and audit your payroll. Look at your job classifications.
Smart.
Look at your employee manual. Look at your job descriptions. And call me before you fire someone.
How do you do that? By the size of the employer? Like, how do you know what to charge for that? Is it
by the
size?
Scope of the anticipated work or need?
So it's kind of
as
a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, yes.
Do you do plaintiff stuff on a contingency?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay, so I got a question.
Sometimes
so
most times.
Age discrimination, you know, what we were talking about, you know, employer discrimination cases,
right,
is pretty obvious. You know, like they were working there for 50 years and then you fired them because they got old, right? So I get that. But in a case, for example, let's say the person's, you know, I don't want to pick on a class, they're Fillion, okay, let's just say, and that's why they're getting canned. That's a protected class, Fillion. Fillion. Wouldn't the counter argument to you fired me because I'm Fillion being, well, I hired you even though you're Fillion?
That's
like, how do you get
argument
past that?
I'm Fillion.
I could say African American or
whatever.
I'm just trying to keep it.
There's a
to
decent
the legal
amount
question
of case law, right, that says that, you know, it doesn't TKO the case, but it certainly is a very strong argument for the employer. Usually, the
or is that like a failure to promote, maybe?
Usually the comeback to that is, well, there was a different person who made the decision to hire me than to fire me.
Things have changed and evolved.
You know, or what's very commonly said is that there's disparate treatment. So you have a black employee and a white employee, and you do hire the black employee. But now you move forward in time, and the black employee has been late for work over the course of 6 months 10 times. And you fire him for that. And then the black employee says, okay, but the white employee, the comparator, right, has been late for work 20 times in the past 6 months. And you didn't fire him. You gave him a raise. So that would be an example where you
That's because he's bringing in business.
Well, that would be your legitimate, non-discriminatory
you know
reason.
What? It's like picking a jury and striking. When you strike, you have to give a non-
discriminatory reason.
Right. And you have to come up with something creative.
Right.
And sometimes you can't, but that's analogous, I would say, correct?
Right, exactly. And so what happens in these cases, they're kind of interesting, a little different than most civil cases. You start out with the plaintiff having to show a prima facie case. They're in a protected category. They suffered an adverse action. And if it's a termination, they were replaced by someone outside the protected category. That's all they have to do. Then the burden of production, not of proof, flips over to the employer to come up and articulate the legitimate non-discriminatory reason for what they did. And then the burden flips back to the employee to show the reason that the employer is giving is pretext. It's an excuse. It's either false or it's just a pretext. And you do that through the kind of usually by comparative evidence. Well, you say it's because I performed at had these performance issues. Well, what about this guy who's in a different category and right. He had the same or worse performance issues and so forth.
Cases go to trial or predominantly resolve pretrial?
Yeah, less than 10% go to trial.
You know, Dan, this is the time of show where we try to get real. Okay.
Let's get real.
Like Donnie.
Because until now, it's been completely and utterly
fake. Get real.
All right.
What
All
is
right.
it that your employers do, like when you take on a new one, let's say, that just makes you shake your head and go, why are they doing this?
The biggest issue I'm seeing right now goes back to the first question about the FLSA. I get so many employers who classify everyone or most of their people as independent contractors.
Oh, okay.
Even though they're not really independent contractors. And it invites a whole host of problems. First of all, you're not paying taxes, right? You're not withholding taxes. The government's not happy about that. Number two, when the independent contractor leaves or is fired, how is he being fired?
Right.
But they get terminated. Then they come back and they say, I was misclassified. And what do? They file for unemployment compensation. And the state of Florida says, well, you haven't been paying your unemployment comp
right,
tax on
right.
this person. Now you've got the Department of Revenue auditing your payroll.
What a Ooh. Nightmare.
Yeah. Now, next thing, they go to the Department of Labor or they go to an attorney and they say, I worked 60 hours a week and they treated me as an independent contractor. They never paid me overtime.
Or deducted or took out for
taxes. Right. So now you've got the IRS is usually the least likely, I guess, to audit of the scenarios, but Department of Labor will come in and do an audit. I've been involved for employers where Department of Labor has come in and said, I want to look at 100 employees. I want to look at all of their payroll records going back 3 or 5 years.
Wow.
And including the people you're calling independent contractors. And you could be in a whole world of hurt
if you do the math.
Where you're paying, because the penalty on the overtime is not just paying the overtime, it's double. If it's shown to be for liquidated damages, if it's shown to be an intentional or willful violation, that's a pretty low standard. Your only defense there as an employer is, hey, I had this vetted through the Department of Labor. I had this vetted through an employment attorney, and they blessed it. But short of that, getting that kind of opinion letter, if you're just flying blind and you say, I thought I could give them a contract and call them an independent contractor.
In other words, no, somebody's not an independent contractor because you say they are. They
got
to meet the criteria, obviously.
No, it has to, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck.
But each state has a different thing. I understand California, give me a business card and an email address. I'm no longer an independent contractor. That's in California. And Uber.
What about Florida?
How do they work?
What's the criteria for independent contractors?
Well, there's then to complicate matters, there's different standards. There's a federal standard, right, under the FLSA, and the IRS has a standard of what an independent contractor is. The Department of Revenue for the state of Florida has a little different standard.
Short version, what is it?
Short version is they look at two major factors. The economic realities. In other words, is the person getting their economic dependency essentially from you in more of a long-term relationship that looks like an employment relationship? And control. How much? Because you know, an independent contractor shouldn't control their day to day, their schedule. Do they have to work a schedule? Do they have rules and regulations of the employment of the employer that have to be followed? Can they be disciplined and so forth? So all of those things, you know, who's providing the materials? Are you reimbursing the person for costs?
So common sense pretty much dictates, it sounds like.
Pretty much.
Well, looks like a duck, talks like a duck, is a duck. Real
or
quick
duck
here, because we do
real
have
quick,
to run.
We got 1 minute.
What is the EEOC? What role do they play?
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has, it's a quasi-law enforcement agency, but basically it investigates and then sometimes prosecutes as like in an attorney general capacity claims of discrimination, federal claims, race, sex, national origin, religion.
What about
disability,
sexual harassment?
Sexual harassment.
And you got to get past
Phil.
You
being investigated
claim, right?
Again?
I'm telling you.
Hey, Dana, we're just about out of time. How would employers or even employees at employers need your help? Employees that need your help get in touch with you.
So the number is 954-894-3035. The website is Gallup, G-A-L-L-U-P, dash, like the hyphen sign,
yeah.
Law, L-A-W.com.
All right. Well, perfect.
And if I wanted to fire Phil Bell, I can tell him right now, terminate him without cause
like
right now. Right at
yeah,
this
but
moment.
I'm giving Phil my card.
Yeah. He's still fired. You can give him
you can I have anytime you want to sue Gary, knock yourself out. Now, on that note, this is Gary Singer, not Gary Oster, wishing all of our listeners, thank you, Dana, for coming on. Gary, always a pleasure to see you. Phil as well, our production staff, our caterers, and most importantly.
And welcome back, Giovanni Lopez.
Welcome back, Giovanni Lopez.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
I want to thank the union crew, the grips, especially the key grips. Yeah. But most importantly, I want to thank our listeners. Be safe.
And be legal.
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448 for legal news and review. Remember, be legal.